Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, at least half of all COVID-19 deaths in New Jersey have occurred at the state's long-term care facilities. David Baril is a doctor of geriatric medicine and is working on the front line treating patients in nursing homes. We'll hear the story from his perspective. Also, the arts can help to sustain us during tough times, but who is sustaining the arts? Many organizations and individual artists are struggling in the pandemic. We'll check in with Maud Lyon of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance. But to begin, we get the latest on the growing tension between the Wolf administration and a handful of Pennsylvania counties which have said they're striking out on their own to lift stay-at-home restrictions and reopen businesses moving without permission into the so-called yellow phase of the state's cautiously choreographed three-tiered plan. The rogue counties have the support of Republican state lawmakers, but Democratic Governor Wolf has moved quickly to try to squelch this action, calling the move cowardly and threatening quick retaliation. Also, the effort to go rogue has left many businesses stuck between a rock and a hard place, torn between the desire to open and the risk of reaction from authorities. WHYY's Katie Meyer has been following this story closely, and she joins us with more. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
So initially, there were five counties which threatened to enter the yellow phase this past Friday, but since then, two have backed away, Katie?
Yeah, so we've seen sort of a scattershot approach here. Obviously, it's something that's really not being coordinated between the counties. So, for instance, in certain places, you have, prosecutors who are saying that they're not going to, prosecute businesses that stay open. But you also have county commissioners say they're no longer going to unilaterally move to reopen. So, for instance, Dauphin County was one of the ones that did that. And so I think it's kind of, there's been a little bit of a lack of clarity to certain to business owners about like what they should do here. But we do still have a couple of counties, yes, as you said, that are moving towards yellow unilaterally. Lancaster is one of them. Beaver County is still doing it. I think Schuylkill is still on the list. So there's definitely, as you said, some tension between them and the governor.
What's the general argument being made by the remaining counties for moving forward more quickly than the state would like?
So there's a couple different things that come up. But basically, they're saying that the governor, is focusing on health and he should be focusing a little bit more on the economy. They say they have, slowed the spread of coronavirus to an acceptable degree, they think, to be able to start reopening, moving as into Wolf's yellow phase that he designated. So, for instance, letting more businesses do curbside pickup and limited reopenings. Daycares would technically be reopened under the yellow phase. So they think they can do that safely. One of the ones I looked at closely was Lancaster. And they still, they have a caseload that is higher than the caseload that the governor has laid out. Mm-hmm. So it's like 50 cases per 100,000 people over 14 days. But they say, because a lot of their cases are in nursing homes, they have a bunch of nursing homes, they believe that they still could safely reopen while putting resources into the nursing homes.
Yes.
So that's the kind of reasoning that you hear from these guys.
And indeed, some state lawmakers have asked the Wolf administration to exclude COVID-19 deaths in nursing homes as indicators of community spread and therefore a factor in moving from red to yellow.
Yep.
How has the Wolf administration responded?
Well, so the administration has basically said they don't want to do that at this point. And we have seen that that ask from counties. A lot of the ones that have moved to reopen are the ones that are controlled by Republicans. And we've seen, though, that ask of excluding nursing home patients from some very Democratic counties. Delaware down by Philadelphia, they have asked for that. I believe Bucks County also made that request. But so far, the Wolf administration has not been amenable to it.
So back to the counties, which have said they are, it's seemingly at least moving into the yellow phase without permission from the administration. Last week, Governor Wolf responded with anger. Is that a good way to characterize his response?
I don't know if he would agree with anger, but certainly, Wolf
passion.
Is usually a guy, people have described him as mild-mannered frequently. Mm-hmm. You see that a lot in the stories about this. And I would say that's accurate. He's a guy who's not really prone to inflammatory language. And he invoked a metaphor about war, saying that the county commissioners and the lawmakers who are pushing to defy his orders are basically deserters. And he got some flack from that. He also said that, yeah, there are certain things he could do to enforce his orders. Now, an emergency order, I talked to, you know, some political professors and some lawyers about this. There's no enforcement mechanism that is necessarily tied to a governor's emergency order, which is what we have in this case. What Wolf can do is take other things that he does have control over. So, for instance, the state controls liquor licenses. The state also controls Department of Health certifications, occupancy certifications. And he said if businesses start reopening against these rules, that he could pull those certifications. He also said that businesses that are acting, you know, not in accordance with state law, because that's what this is right now, could lose their insurance. He also kind of made, I would say it's kind of a threat to counties that don't follow his orders, and said that he could withhold federal funding, so, you know, from the Federal CARES Act. So there's a bunch of things that the governor says he could do. And it's kind of TBD, to be determined on, like, whether he actually will follow through on these things.
Sure. So at the end of the day, many businesses in these counties in question are kind of stuck uncomfortably in the middle, not sure how to proceed and whether they can proceed without ramification, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think I talked to Gene Barr, who he heads the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry, and he's been getting, you know, he said quite a few calls from people who are asking, you know, hey, what should I do here? Should I reopen my business? Should I stay closed? I mean, you know, people are losing a lot of money, so this is a very real decision that they have to make. And Gene said, you know, they now have sort of guidance on their website, and basically what he said is, you know, the counties, even if they say they're reopening, they're going to have a hard time protecting you. So there are certain things that you should check. You should check, you know, what your insurance carrier is going to do. You should check which state licenses you have. And, you know, after that, I think basically the message to counties, and this is coming, or to business owners rather, and this is coming from counties as well, is that you kind of have to make your own call here.
Yeah. Proceed at your own risk.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So there has been support or maybe pressure for earlier reopening in some spots from Republican state lawmakers, correct? You alluded to this earlier. And I'm wondering,
yes,
if there's a chicken
has.
Or egg situation here. Did the Republican state lawmakers get the ball rolling on this, or were they county officials in some counties?
Yeah, that's been a really interesting question. So from what I could gather, a lot of these pushes by counties to reopen have been started by GOP lawmakers. So I spent some time looking at two counties where this was definitely the case, Cumberland, which actually has already gotten the go-ahead to start reopening and move into the yellow phase, and also Franklin. And in both cases, I talked to county commissioners who said that they basically were given letters that had been drafted by their county like state representatives in their counties and state senators. And they hadn't seen those letters before. They didn't agree with what the letter said, which was, we are reopening.
Ah.
And so they both communicated with the Wolf administration and said, you know, on no terms are we reopening. So there was a very clear difference between what the state lawmakers wanted to do and what the county officials wanted to do.
And some of these county officials, some of these county officials were Republican, the ones who were hesitant about reopening?
Yes.
Okay.
So both of the ones that I talked to were Republicans. So it was Gary Eichelberger in Cumberland County, and it was Keller, and I'm forgetting his first name, but Commissioner Keller in Franklin County, David Keller.
It sounds as if, Katie, it sounds as if that perhaps this process was started by some Republican state lawmakers.
I mean, it certainly does sound like that. And I can't say whether it was in every single county. Certainly, yeah. We have seen county commissioners sign on to these letters. In Lancaster County, two of the Republican commissioners were fully on board. But yes, I think you're absolutely right to say that in some areas, at the very least, you know, state lawmakers were the ones starting this process. And remember, I mean, we have a three-branch system of government that they are one branch of. So they can't unilaterally say the county where I, you know, represent constituents is reopening. You know, county commissioners are the ones who actually, you know, carry out policy on the ground in these counties. And so that tension is very real. And I think when county commissioners say, you know, don't listen to them, we're not reopening, that's something that the people in those counties should take to heart.
Yeah. On Friday, this past Friday, Katie Meyer, there was news that 12 more counties would move later on this week from red to yellow, bringing the total to 49. And again, the three rogue counties, again, tell us whether they are in this batch.
Sure. So at this point, the counties that I think are clearly planning to start reopening are Beaver and Schuylkill and Lancaster. And they are not reopening yet. Beaver was in the most recent recent wave of counties. It's hard to keep track of all these guys. but there are still some that aren't reopening. And so we're going to have to see what actually happens here.
Southeastern Pennsylvania, still firmly in the red, correct?
Still firmly in the red, yes. And even though we haven't seen the kind of, you know, gestures toward unilateral action in southeastern PA, we definitely still have seen tension. I mean, I was watching a Montgomery County press briefing the other day, and you know, in Montgomery County, there's two Democratic county commissioners and one Republican. The Republican county commissioner in Montco was very upset by the fact that the county has not been pushing more strongly to reopen. And so I think we are starting to see these officials chafing at these things. And I mentioned before, you know, Delaware County, Berks County, all in the Philly suburbs, have started to wonder if they could, you know, begin reopening, even if they didn't count their nursing home data. So again, like, even if there isn't like this, you know, outright political tension, you're definitely still seeing people very concerned about what businesses staying closed is going to mean.
Yeah. And I believe I read, too, that there's also some pressure for reopening, some sort of reopening in Bucks County. And I know that after decades of Republican control, Democrats took the lead in Bucks earlier this year. So it would seem perhaps, I don't have names, but perhaps Democrats are also, some Democrats are chomping at the bit as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Bucks County is seeing the same thing. But I will say one thing. I mean, there's always going to be a political aspect to this. And I think in every single county, you see people kind of making these considerations about, you know, what's going to happen. I mean, Governor Wolf is not up for re-election again, but we certainly have big elections coming up. So I think Democrats are starting to wonder, okay, what does this mean for, you know, our swing voters here? And the one thing I will say is, so far, it looks like the governor's approach to reopening has been overwhelmingly popular with Pennsylvanians. So, you know, polling that we've seen, the Washington Post had a poll out pretty recently, showed that a pretty strong majority of Pennsylvanians is still on board with this sort of slower reopening that we've been seeing.
All right. And there is a target date for at least some reopening overall. That is June 4th, correct? But it's only a target.
June 4th. Yes. And we will have to see what happens on June 4th. I mean, the governor has he's extended his stay at home orders a couple times now, and he could do that again. So it really does depend on the caseloads that we're seeing then.
OK, as we say, stay tuned.
Exactly.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Myers, political reporter for WHYY. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we talk about nursing homes a little bit more in depth. In New Jersey, fully half of all COVID deaths are attributed to long-term care facilities. Dr. David Baril will be our guest. Stay tuned. Welcome.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to Radio Times, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. New Jersey's nursing homes and veteran care facilities have been ravaged by the coronavirus. Fully half of all deaths linked to COVID-19 in the Garden State have occurred at long-term care facilities, compared to the national average of about a third. Both residents and staff are falling ill, and now hundreds of National Guard members have been deployed to provide support. It might be argued that the frail elderly and their caregivers were sitting ducks for something like the coronavirus. Living conditions in such facilities are usually close, staffing is tight, and according to published reports, PPE is often lacking. Now, an investigation by the Asbury Park Press and USA Today has found that 8 out of 10 New Jersey nursing homes with COVID patients had been warned prior to the pandemic that they weren't following mandatory infection control standards. Questions, comments, here's the email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. David Baril has seen the devastation of this virus on the elderly in care facilities firsthand. He is a doctor of geriatric medicine and palliative care and founder of the Goals of Care Coalition of New Jersey. Good to have you with us, David Baril.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's take a no-holds-barred look at what's happening in many nursing homes. You are, you know, a medical professional working on the front line. And, David, you told our producer, John Ahrens, that the last few weeks have been absolute hell.
Yeah, for myself and for the few facilities that I'm working in and for most of the nursing homes in New Jersey. And we're all experiencing this wave of cases and a lot of deaths. And it's traumatic for everyone. It's traumatic for the family members, for the healthcare providers in these facilities. And we're all experiencing a lot of pressure given the staffing crisis and the PPE crisis.
Give us a sense of who the patients are, what life is normally like for them, and how everything changes when there is a diagnosis of COVID-19 in the facility.
Yeah, and I think that's important for your listeners to know. The average nursing home will bring together residents in a common dining area, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So all the residents will come out of their rooms and eat together around a common table. They'll get assistance with aides, nursing aides, if they need assistance with meal preparation and so on. And, of course, there'll be social events throughout the day. Now, with COVID, with the lockdown, all of the residents are secured in their rooms. They're not allowed to come out of the rooms. And the main crisis, I think, that we're having now is the lack of staffing. So a lot of the nurses are out sick. A lot of the aides are out sick. And we just don't have enough staff to properly care for the basic needs of these frail elders. And it's not just those with COVID. It's those people without COVID also that are bedbound and just not getting the attention they need.
So when you say their basic needs aren't being taken care of, what do you mean?
Well, there's with the staffing crisis, it takes a lot to care for a frail elder. You've got to get them up out of bed. You've got to get them washed and dressed. You've got to get them fed. If they're not able to do these basic activities of daily living on their own, they need help. So there's just not enough help to go around. So it's unfortunate, and it's also concerning because I really don't see, and you probably don't see anytime soon where we'll be able to lift these restrictions. I can't imagine in the next month or two the seniors being allowed to come out of their rooms or family members to visit again. So we've really got to come up with a solution quickly.
Is it fair to say that one of the biggest dangers to the elderly in all of this is isolation?
Absolutely. And a lot of people are forgetting that, you know, even with mild cognitive impairment, if someone just has mild memory loss, if they're left in a room all day, that dementia syndrome can get worse. And depression absolutely will set in if it hasn't already for many of them. And then there are complications with just having an older person just not moving about. Muscle loss, muscle strength is accelerated. The rates of hip fractures and falls, I think we'll see increase, and I've already seen some of these patients come into our local hospital with such problems.
And yet, would we have been able to do anything differently?
Well, you know, it's so easy to point fingers, and that's what everyone is doing now, and it's just awful. Of course, we can draw a line straight to President Trump and the federal response or lack thereof early on in this crisis. We can point fingers at the governor and the Department of Health, but I think that we need to come up with some creative staffing solutions urgently to get people into these buildings. Now, the governor did release the National Guard
Yes.
to some facilities. My understanding is, though, it appears to be on a first-come, first-served basis. While we were promised that they would be distributed based on need, that hasn't occurred. I'm hoping that the next round of deployment will be based on actual need. Every day, the nursing homes need to fill out, I think by 11 o'clock, a survey for the Department of Health, an online survey, where they report staffing needs and concerns. So they are watching that. But I think we need to more strategically place the guardsmen in facilities that need them.
And when the guardsmen are deployed in certain facilities, can they fully participate in a patient's care? Are they kind of on the perimeter?
Kind of on the perimeter. I mean, they're helpful, and I've spoken with I've spoken with administrators of nursing homes, and they're certainly helpful. And just today, I ran into some guardsmen at a local facility, and I honestly got choked up, you know, seeing these young people in their military garb actively helping out, and I thank them for doing that. And it was wonderful to see them. But they're, for the most part, they're doing custodial care. They're helping with cleaning. They're answering phones. They are permitted to deliver the food tray into the patient's room, leave it there, and walk out. So they're not trained to feed the residents, which is really critical. And it only takes an hour or 2 hour in service to teach anyone how to help an elder with eating. So it's unfortunate that they're not permitted to help feed the residents, because I think that's key. But they are providing a good service.
Do they have an opportunity to communicate briefly with the residents, mask on, and et cetera?
They do. They do. How much of that is going on, I actually can't speak to, but absolutely, they are in the rooms. But for the most part, they're supporting the existing staff, the already depleted staff that are in the buildings.
We are speaking with David Burreel, Doctor of Geriatric Medicine and Palliative Care, and founder and chief medical officer of Goals of Care Coalition of New Jersey. And we'll talk about the coalition in just a bit. But David Burreel, wanted to talk about an order from Governor Murphy, who has mandated that all patients now and staff be tested for the virus in the state's, I think it's like 670 long-term care facilities. Do we know how positive results of this testing will be handled? Will patients be moved to hospitals? Will staff be replaced? Do we know any of that?
Well, no. If the residents test positive, then they'll be secured in a location in the building with other positive cases. So there'll be clustering of positive cases and people who test negative. And I think most facilities will be able to manage that. The real crisis, I think, will be, again, in staffing. So imagine that you've already got a depleted staff, your nurses and your nursing aides. You're maybe operating at 50% or 60% capacity. And now half of them test positive for COVID. They've got to go home. So agency staffers are not available. And it may present a big problem. And this is one of the beefs that a lot of the local Department of Health and nursing homes are having now with this mandate. There's no provision. There's no provision or strategic plan for the state to help with those staff members who may need to go home if they test positive.
And is the state addressing this at all? I mean, there's nothing in place, but is there any early response as to how this might be handled?
Well, that's a good question for the governor in today's briefing. So if there's a reporter there, let's ask them.
Describe the people who do care for residents on a daily basis, David Burreel, the staff and the challenges that they face, and frankly, are they compensated enough?
Well, in general terms, I mean, these are low wage jobs, right? So, and this is one of the reasons why, one of the explanations we think why the virus spread to so many facilities across the nation. That's because people, most aides or nurses don't just have one job. They work in several facilities just to make ends meet. So they were possibly carriers of the virus and help with the spread. So that is an issue. We're not paying these folks enough. And the same argument as teachers, right? These are really hardworking professionals who really deserve better pay. But it's certainly a challenge getting people to do this kind of work. And it's really unfortunate. You know, I spend half of my working day in a hospital setting, and the other half in a nursing home setting. And while if you're a healthcare worker in the hospital, you're applauded as a hero, and we pass signs of encouragement going into the front door, and restaurants bring you food. But if you're working in a nursing home now and on the front lines caring for COVID, risking your own health and the health of your family members, you get very little support, I think, and a lot of shame, a lot of fingers pointed at the nursing home industry and at the people that work here in these facilities. And it's unfortunate. We need a much more enlightened approach, absolutely, to this industry.
And I guess these staff members are feeling the difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Morale is low, and it's really hard. You know, we in my own facility, we lost nearly 20 residents out of 110 or so. And we've turned a corner now. And in the last week, we've had at least 7 days of no fevers and no deaths, and everyone is beginning to eat again and feel better. But it was really, really traumatic on the morale, on the soul of the building. And it's going to take a long time to recover.
You find yourself serving as chaplain as well as physician. Describe that experience, David Burrell.
There was, I think, the lowest point in this past month during this crisis in the nursing home, when we were having a lot of deaths and people getting suddenly sick, and just there were some elders just dying within hours, others just sort of presenting with weakness and altered mental status. It presents very atypically in frail elders. And on one occasion, I was caring for a resident, and I heard screaming down the hallway. I went to look, and a younger patient, a patient who was in her 50s with MS, died suddenly. And she likely had a thromboembolic event. This is like a blood clot that might travel. And we see this phenomenon with COVID. And I attempted CPR and could not revive her. And when I left the room and shared with the nursing staff and the aides that have been caring for this woman for years, who were very, very close with this woman, when I shared the news that she had died, they all began weeping and wailing and the arms up in the air and kind of ran off in different areas saying, I can't take it anymore. I can't take it anymore. And I was in a position where I had to settle everyone and bring everyone together. And before calling the family or doing anything else, I gathered up all of the staff, and there were maybe five or six of them there. And I wish I could remember what I said to them, but I did, as to the best of my ability, I supported them and acknowledged how difficult this work is, but how important it is, and that we've got to stay together and we've got to stay true to our mission, providing good care, good loving care. And it was really, really hard, but I found myself sort of functioning like a chaplain, offering some peace and comfort. And that was a role that I'd never, ever had to do. But it certainly made me appreciate the work of hospital chaplains and nursing home chaplains.
Yeah. I'm going to hazard a guess here that there is next to no psychological support for these staff members and even yourself going through this.
Minimal. But, you know, one of the sad facts here, and I think it's been very sort of dysfunctional the way our State Department of Health has been managing this crisis. They've just to draw this analogy, it may not be fair, but just how Trump has asked the states to kind of fend for their own and order their own supplies, and states have to compete against one another. The State Department of Health have also sort of done that with the counties and the local Department of Health, and the local Department of Health now need to care for and provide services and PPE and coordination for the nursing homes, and they're overwhelmed. And so this last week or so, it's occurred to me that local communities are really on their own managing this. And we've done something really extraordinary. Trinity Church, a local church in our town, reached out to me to see how they could help. And by the end of the conversation, we realized that our staff really need moral, psychological support, sure, spiritual support. So the priest at Trinity Church and their staff members will be reaching out to provide this kind of support for our employees. So we're tapping into local resources, basically. And hopefully that may be a model for other facilities.
But looking ahead, it sounds as if the nursing home you work with has turned a corner. But with this, say, scattershot approach in mind on the federal, the state, the local governments, or at least the federal and state governments, looking ahead to the possibility of a second wave, how do we prepare?
It's a good question. It's a good question. And we really need leadership from the top, better leadership from the federal level, and better preparation and leadership from the Department of Health and the governor at the state level. We need a more concerted effort to distribute PPE. I think we're still waiting for that PPE that the governor struck a deal with Trump. It was April 30th, I think. I don't know if any of that made it to the state. So we need a more concerted effort, I think a coordinated effort. And we need the governor and the Department of Health to come up with some innovative idea, something out of the box. You know, we need waivers to get healthcare volunteers into these buildings. One idea we've come up with locally is to have a assistant to the activities director. All nursing homes have an activities director. That person's responsible for games and socialization and so on. They need a special license to get that job, but their assistants don't, right? So we may be able to do a kind of workaround and get people to come into these facilities, either on a volunteer basis or a paid basis, to work as activities directors, and we can train them to feed residents and help out in that way. But in terms of preparing for the future, it's a challenge, and we need some really creative solutions.
How are you doing in all this?
Do we have enough time?
We've got about 45 seconds, unfortunately.
I wake up every morning. I do 5 or 10 minutes of yoga. I go to work, and I work really hard all day. I haven't had a day off, I think, since mid-March. But I come home, and I thoroughly enjoy my family, my kids, my wife, and my pets. And in a way, for some, I feel fortunate and lucky that I'm blessed to be doing good work, and I have a job. I can, you know, provide food to the table. And but it's for me, it's a really, in some ways, kind of an eye-opening experience about, you know, you've really got to count your blessings. I mean, how else can you make sense of this, right?
Yeah.
You've got to just count your blessings and just try to stay healthy and carry on.
David Brill, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for being there.
Thank you for having me.
All right, David Brill is Doctor of Geriatric Medicine and Palliative Care and founder and Chief Medical Officer of Goals of Care Coalition of New Jersey. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we talk about how the arts have been affected by the pandemic. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Philadelphia is inextricably linked to the arts. The Museum of Art, the Orchestra, Opera Philadelphia, the Kimmel Center, the Fringe Festival, Mural Arts, the city's numerous community arts groups and independent artists, and so much more. The arts pour $4 billion into the local economy. And this year, of course, the spigot has been almost completely turned off thanks to the pandemic. So what will be left when the normal flow of life resumes? How are arts organizations communicating with patrons, realigning budgets, preparing for uncharted territory in the months and years ahead, and in some cases just trying to stay alive? Questions or comments? Here is the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Our guest for the remainder of the hour is Maud Lyon, president of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance. Hello, Maud. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
So characterize the arts and their place in Philadelphia's identity, their part in making the city what it is, Maud.
Oh, I mean, can you imagine Philadelphia without the murals everywhere? Can
No.
you imagine it without the incredible music and the performing arts groups we have, the dancers, the can you, what about our theater community, which is so vibrant at every level? I mean, arts and culture is part of who we are. It's in every neighborhood. It's about how we communicate with each other. I think it's no accident that as soon as the pandemic hit, you were seeing singers performing. You were seeing, you know, memes being created. You've got, you know, wall art being done by the artists of mural arts all over the city. You've got artists stepping up and doing things to help with food insecurity and so forth. I mean, the arts are just simply part of who we are in Philadelphia.
There has been a lot of uncertainty, though. Describe at least, you know, some of the damage that has been done by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, to understand that, you have to understand that about half of what sustains arts and culture is earned revenue. And this is overall for some organizations. It's a much higher percentage than that. When the pandemic hit, every single activity had to be canceled because you could no longer get people together, either to perform or to be in the audience or even to attend a museum or a public garden. So all of the earned revenue abruptly ended, and it also happened at the time when we have traditionally all the spring fundraisers that help with the contributed revenue. So arts and culture organizations that typically don't have more than a couple of months of unrestricted revenue, they sail pretty close to the wind in their budgets. So to have this sudden and abrupt ending of all revenue is absolutely devastating.
Among the most vulnerable in the cultural sector are the individual artists and the small and medium-sized arts groups. What does Maud Lyon, what does funding generally look like for them during the best of times? I mean, where does their money come from?
Well, their money comes from a number of places. I mean, one is that that they are hired by the organizations. These are the actors, the musicians, the visual artists, the arts educators. So when public programming had to cease, when theaters had to close their door, immediately all of those artists lost work by contract. Many of them also have secondary jobs doing other things, and a lot of them lost that work as well. So they got hit double. Artists also, if let's say you're an independent musician and you're going to perform, say, at a jazz club or, you know, some other venue, all of a sudden you can't do that either. So it's in the artists, especially those that are independent contractors, they don't have employers. It's harder for them to file for unemployment. So it's been really devastating to the community of artists. Small arts organizations also don't have they tend to operate with very small budgets, and they don't have a lot of financial reserves. And so there's not a lot to fall back on. They don't have major donors. They really rely on the flow of their work in order to sustain it. And when that flow is cut off, they're out of luck.
So we're not talking about the smaller groups and the individual artists. Grant money, endowments, that sort of thing.
Well, only about a quarter of our organizations had any kind of endowment or investment. Mm-hmm. So typically endowment money is in older and larger organizations. Most organizations don't have that asset at all. So they are really depending upon contributed and earned revenue to be able to, and this is true of mid-sized organizations as well. So literally organizations up to, you know, $10 or $15 million, you know, all depend heavily on contributed and earned revenue.
So if some of these artists and groups go under, how does that change Philadelphia's identity? What would you envision?
The ones I worry about the most are two categories. One is the mid-sized organizations. So say between, $250,000 up to $15 million, because especially as you get to $10 to $15 million, that's where all of our major theaters are. Many of our museums are in there. Our major arts education organizations. Those are not replaceable. If they were to go away, if they were not able to weather this storm, and typically they have just as a group, they have higher cost structures that are harder to adjust, and they don't have the donors that some of the largest organizations do, and they also don't have the endowments. So they, if you look at fiscal analysis, they always come in as the most vulnerable in the sector. The other part of the sector I worry about is the diverse part of the sector, the organizations of color, the people, the ones that are founded in neighborhoods and do a lot of work in communities and with specific communities of people, because they in Philadelphia have been historically underfunded, and therefore they don't have a lot of reserves to fall back on.
And if we lose their art, it could be devastating to the neighborhoods they're in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We would lose an artistic heritage that is part of who we are as a people. We would lose what connects us together. I think it's also important to realize that these are the organizations that work in the neighborhoods and produce out-of-school-time programming for young people. They produce healthy activities for seniors that keep them engaged and socially engaged and alive. The seniors have a 48% less chance of depression if they are engaged in arts and culture activities. So just as an example. So we know that arts and culture is more effective for at-risk youth in keeping them in school and keeping them seeing their value as a person and being able to develop their own skills and competencies. So these are the things that are really at risk.
Maud Lyon is president of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, and we are also joined now by Catherine Cahill, president, CEO and chairman of the board, if I'm reading this correctly, of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance. Catherine joins us as well. Hi, Catherine.
Hi there, and good morning, Marty and Maud. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to allow me to join this important call. I am very proud to be the chairwoman for the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, and my other full-time job, of course, I'm president and CEO of the Mann Center. So delighted to be on the call with you.
Well, thanks so much, Catherine. Yes, I was going to get to some of the larger entities. The Mann Center, tell us about the changes wrought at the Mann Center by the coronavirus pandemic and what needs to happen with entities like Mann to help keep it afloat and in a healthful position as we try to get through this pandemic.
Well, thank you so much. It's a great question. Many of the larger cultural institutions, as Maud has mentioned, have huge physical plants and infrastructure that needs to be cared for, even when their earned revenue contributions are dramatically decreased. We are anticipating a significantly reduced season, possibly no season at all, if the authorities don't allow us to open. That's unclear yet. So we remain hopeful, but we're also cautious in understanding that safety comes first. I think most of us are in deep scenario planning, trying to understand the impact of lost earned revenue, and then the impact also on contributed revenue. Many of our corporate and foundation leaders, their first priority, and rightly so right now, are taking care of the social service agencies, food and shelter and things of that nature as we go through this. Sure. But I think any vibrant and thriving city, which Philadelphia will become again, is really defined in history by civilization, if you will, by its art, its culture, its literature, its architecture, and Philadelphia is no exception. So making sure that we invest in these arts organizations, the Mann included, of course, is critical to the recovery of the city as we get to the other side of this, and we will. I mean, Philadelphia, if you think about it, has survived two world wars, the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, the Great Depression, 9/11, 2008, and here we are.
Well, we welcome.
Philadelphia has strong history of survival and being a determined and amazing place of resilient residents.
Well, nice to hear an optimistic perspective, Catherine. Thank you so much for that. Quick, because we're running a little short on time. I did want to get into virtual performances. Some organizations are doing this to try to keep the presence alive, but also perhaps to bring some money in. And this for you or for Maud, how much is this helping the arts community in the Philadelphia area?
Well, just as I think the news media has struggled to have online subscriptions and so forth make up for the loss of their traditional print model, arts and culture organizations really depend upon people getting together and people in community. So yes, there are some online programs that, like for example, music lessons and things like that that are fee for service, and I think those are doing fairly well. But most of the online programming that museums or performing arts or others groups are using are putting out there are free to the public. So there's no way that the arts can pivot immediately and suddenly make up on virtual programming what they've lost in actual programming. To the public, that's a great benefit to the public. It's wonderful programming, but it's not going to financially make the gap.
Okay, we've got a question from a caller.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, Marty, one of the other things that people are doing with virtual, and Walt is correct, it's not really monetizing the losses by any stretch, but they are using them in certain instances as fundraisers, like the Metropolitan Opera did a virtual gala fundraiser. And so there are a number of those happening, but they are sort of one-offs, and they absolutely make a difference, but they're not going to change the trajectory for the immediate near future in any way in making up some of these financial losses. But they are a way to connect your brand and keep your stakeholders engaged.
Okay, so we've got, I'd like to get a quick comment from a caller in who actually has a question. What about cuts to the film industry in Philadelphia? Maude, can you tell us anything about that?
Well, the proposed budget, which, and we all know we have to share in the sacrifice of the city making adjustments to deal with this pandemic and what must be done for the good of everyone. But the film office, museums, the Philadelphia Cultural Fund, the Office of Arts, Culture, and the Creative Economy, all of those are eliminated in what is proposed to the city budget. And once those things are completely eliminated, it's going to be very hard to bring them back. The film office has brought us all kinds of movies and fame and certainly helped Philadelphia be on the map in important ways. So do the arts and culture organizations. We're also an anchor of the tourism industry, which is hugely important to the city of Philadelphia.
So this perhaps is a good point to bring COVID-19 Arts Aid, PHL, into the conversation. Tell us about this.
Well, we are very pleased. The Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, the Office of Arts, Culture, and the Creative Economy, and the Philadelphia Cultural Fund partnered together to address what you asked me about in the beginning, small arts organizations and artists, to be able to provide relief funding for them. And I'm happy to say we have been able to provide over 1,000 grants so far, and we have more coming. We'll be opening the grant applications for the mid-sized organizations soon. We are hugely grateful to the William Penn Foundation for their leadership and the Vera Foundation. We have more than 15 different foundations that have contributed to this fund, and we have over 84 individual donors that have also contributed. But it also is important to realize that private funding can't make up for public funding, and that public funding has a role to play, which is why we're so concerned about the Philadelphia Cultural Fund.
Yeah. Catherine Cahill, what can arts lovers do on a grassroots level to help keep the arts alive in Philadelphia through this?
Well, first and foremost, they can continue to contribute and make donations that they're comfortable with making during this time. Many cultural organizations depend on more than half of their revenue from donations, charitable giving. So first and foremost, continue to donate to your organizations. If you've bought tickets, frankly, and the performances or the show have been postponed, donate the proceeds of those tickets back to the organizations that you support and you care about. Because quite frankly, to Maud's point, with the lack of earned revenue coming in, the only capacity right now for many organizations to bring in much-needed operating cash is through donations. And so now is the time, if you are able, to continue to make a donation, if you can increase your donation even better. But the arts are critically important. We are an economic driver to the city. And all of these folks that will no longer be employed, we're contributing to the tax base. They're just as important, frankly, the wig maker, the ticket taker, the usher, the secretary in the office. They're just as important as economic contributors to the tax bases as the valued services of the folks that work, say, at an airport or work in a restaurant. They're equally important. They have families to feed, and the loss of those jobs will be devastating to the city. So please continue to contribute to the organizations you cherish, you love, and believe in. Yeah. And help us get to the other side of this when things improve.
All right, and we'll keep an eye on this story as the region starts to phase toward reopening. We'll take a look at the arts down the road as well. Thank you so much for joining us. Catherine Cahill, thanks for calling in, Chairwoman of the Board of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance. And Maude Lyon, great to have you along. Thank you so much for joining us. Maude Lyon is President of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance. Thanks so much, Maude.
Thank you.
And as always, we invite you to visit us on social media. Just head to WHYY.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, John Ahrens, Debbie Boulder, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us for Radio Times. Be well.